Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, the music business in 2024. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
Now, this week we are deviating from our usual format because, well, obviously, normally we look back at the biggest and most interesting stories in the music industry of the last week. But because Chris is off gallivanting, we're recording this before anything has really happened in the music business this week. So we're not going to talk about that because it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, we are recording this on Monday evening. I am going to Ment in Ljubljana in Slovenia, one of my favourite annual events. Really excited to be going back there to talk about streaming and AI. But this is not a plug. And the reason why I can tell you this is not a plug is because by the time this podcast goes out, it will have happened. So it's too late. I'm sure it was great, my streaming panel and my AI speed briefing. But it does mean, yeah, I'm not in London at the usual recording slot. Nothing's happened yet. So we thought we'd do a bit of a special edition. We used to do special editions on a more regular basis. In fact, we used to do special editions on a sufficiently regular basis. And I'm not quite sure why they were special.
Well, good point.
Whereas this is truly special because it's ages since we've done a special edition.
It's very, very special. Yeah, it's so special. It is. It's very special because we're going to talk about the music business in 2024. But Chris, why are we going to talk about the music business in 2024?
Well, two reasons. First of all, you may have noticed at the end of last year, we didn't do our usual what were the key trends of the last 12 months podcast. There was a reason for that. So over recent weeks, I've been delivering a series of CMU masterclasses, and we basically deliver these masterclasses both live and then they're available on demand through the CMU learning platform, and they build as I deliver them live. They're then available on demand through our learning platform, and we're delivering them in sets of four. And as this podcast goes out, I have just finished this week the first set of four for 2024, where we basically delved into some key music business trends. So what we thought we would do is we'd go through each of the masterclasses I have delivered in recent weeks, and I would pick out a couple of the key music business trends I talked about in that masterclass. And in doing so, you'll get your little 12-month review of the key issues, debates, disputes, and trends you should all be aware of. And maybe, if you find this interesting, you might want to check out some of the masterclasses, individual sessions, or all four, where we dig in a lot more detail in all of the stuff we're going to talk about today. So that's the format.
Yes. So there will be, if you do want to, but you don't have to. This is just going to be an interesting podcast on its own. You don't have to do anything. We're not selling you anything when we are, obviously. But this is going to be an enjoyable podcast, and it's not us just pushing stuff to you. But if you do want to delve any further into any of this, there will be a link in the show notes where you can access the masterclasses.
For fans of the news, do not worry, because although we're going with this different format for this week, a little bit of a sort of look back at the last 12 months, the next 12 months, key trends, there will be a bit in the middle with actual news, because while I will be in Slovenia this week, that Andy Malt will not be. So he is going to do you a little news in brief section in the middle, speeding through, I don't know, 4, 5, 87, I don't know how many he's going to do, stories from the week. So there will be a little bit of newsy in brief in the middle. So we're going to do two of our masterclasses, two key points from each of them. Then you'll get the news in brief, and then we'll do the other two. That's how it's going to work.
Okay, so let's go to masterclass number one, which, like this edition of the podcast, is called The Music Business in 2024. And among the things it covers are the key music revenue streams and what's changed, how artist businesses are evolving, the revival of live music, and why AI has dominated the headlines in the last 12 months.
So as the first session in this set of four masterclasses, this is the big picture session where we are looking at all of the different strands of the music industry. And we always organise the music industry around the different revenue streams, the different way artists make money. So obviously there are your intellectual property and copyright revenue streams, there are your live revenue streams, and there are your direct-to-fan revenue streams. Although, because we have separate masterclasses on streaming and copyright, which we're going to pull some key points out of later on this edition of Setlist. I fought for the 2 points to pull out of this masterclass to share here today. We should focus on the live revenue streams and the fan relationship revenue streams rather than the copyright revenue streams. So I've basically given Andy a list of all the key points I want to talk about, and he's going to introduce them, and I'll give you a quick summary of what we talked about in the masterclass.
Yeah, okay. So number one, the upper end of live has bounced back, but mid-tier is struggling and the grassroots is in crisis.
Yes. So some of you working on the live side of the business, or maybe you're artists or you manage artists and touring and shows is a big part of what you do, you'll notice that in the little intro to this masterclass that Andy ran through, we talked about the revival of live music over the last year. And as we currently enter spring 2024, you might be thinking, what revival? But let's not forget, last year, every quarter, Live Nation, biggest live music company in the world, put out its quarterly update to investors and kept telling everybody willing to listen or read, they always put out some quite nifty infographics of each of their investor updates, just how well the biggest live music company in the world is doing. Here's some stats from the quarterly report they put out last autumn. 92% of fans plan to go to more shows or the same amount of shows. They went with the more positive of that. But nevertheless, 92% of music fans are either going to go to as many shows or more shows in the next year. Also, quarter three for Live Nation last year was the biggest quarter ever for the biggest live music company in the world. And they reported that they were seeing double-digit growth for large venue show pipeline and sponsorship for 2024. So I think what the Live Nation stats are demonstrating is that at the upper level of live music, with the arena shows, the stadium shows, the big tours, the big venues, the live music industry is back. Back from where? Back, obviously, from COVID oblivion. The live side of the business did see 2 years, basically, where everything was on hold. Then the lockdowns lifted, the tours restarted, the venues reopened. And as we say, at the upper end of the business, it is very much, we're back, we're booming, and the big shows, the big venues are seeing their revenues growing even compared to 2019, pre-pandemic. Everything is good at the upper end. Meanwhile, at the grassroots of live music, the smaller venues, the smaller shows, basically the grassroots live sector is very much in crisis mode at the moment. If anything, things are worse now than they were during the pandemic, where at least in some countries, at least there was some support available for grassroots venues and grassroots promoters, but no more. So the Music Venue Trust recently reported that though all of the grassroots venues across the UK, that network of smaller music venues, together brought in £500 million of revenue in 2023, the profit margin the venues are currently operating at is 0.5%, and 38.5% of UK grassroots venues made a loss. Now, of course, we know at the grassroots end of live, it's always difficult to make money for the venues, for the promoters, and for the artists who are touring at that level. But at the moment, because production costs are surging, touring costs are surging, but most artists and promoters and venues are finding that they're not able to increase ticket prices to the same degree, we're at real crisis mode in the grassroots of live. Although also interestingly, the mid-tier, the sort of the slightly bigger venues, not the grassroots venues, but not the massive theatres and the arenas, in the mid-tier, we're also seeing an increasing number of artists and promoters talking about that it's much, much harder to generate a decent profit margin out of live shows at the moment. So it's not just the grassroots where we're seeing the challenges. There are also challenges in the mid-tier. Meanwhile, the upper end is booming. What do we do about that? Well, there are various proposals from the industry, which we have talked about on Setlist before and which we do cover in the masterclass. And I'm pretty certain we're going to come back to this in future editions of the podcast because it's very much a live topic and there's often announcements and reports and stats to share. So get the masterclass for the fuller story or keep listening to Setlist, or even better, both.
Okay, number two, the major labels are increasingly focused on the direct-to-fan opportunity.
They are indeed. And not wishing to diss the major record companies, because we never diss the major record companies.
Never.
Here on Setlist, that's not what we do. But at CMU, we have been excited about the direct-to-fan opportunity for, what, 15 years now? Because obviously, in many ways, the most exciting thing that digital did for the music industry was it gave artists a more direct connection to the core fan base. And obviously, over the years, we've seen some artists really capitalise on that and set up their own artist stores and do the pre-order and the fan funding thing and find ways to super serve the super fans to generate extra income. So that fan relationship side of an artist business for some artists has been really important for many years now. But it does feel like more people in the industry now are trying to get involved in the super fan opportunity, possibly because last year the bankers over at Goldman Sachs, I know Andy's a big fan of the bankers at Goldman Sachs. You're always talking about the bankers over at Goldman Sachs, aren't you?
Yeah, I've got posters on my wall, everything.
Big fan. Well, to be fair to the bankers at Goldman Sachs, they do this annual report called the Music in the Air report, which is usually quite interesting. And one of the things that they talked about, looking at the opportunities in the music industry over the next 10 years, is super serving superfans. They said, we see opportunities to drive greater monetization of superfans, where our analysis suggests up to a $4.2 billion potential revenue opportunity over time. So, therefore, not at all surprising that in their memos to their employees at the start of this year, both Lucian Grange at Universal Music, Robert Kinkle at Warner Music, talking up the direct fan opportunity and how those labels are going to be working with their artists to unlock that potential this year. What does interest me about direct fan? As I say, we've been talking about this for many years now. Some artists, some managers, and indeed some labels have been doing this for quite some time. But it does seem in more recent years, for various reasons, the direct fan opportunity is increasingly digital. And that might seem like a weird thing to say, because I started off by saying direct fan's exciting because digital allows artists to have a direct connection with the core fan base. But until relatively recently, although the connection was digital, often what you were selling to the fan was something physical, a t-shirt, a CD, vinyl, whatever. And then you were mailing it directly to them. And you'd use a platform like Bandcamp or maybe a Shopify store to enable that to happen. Whereas, increasingly, we're seeing artists, particularly with younger fan bases, offering digital content and experiences, membership schemes, fan clubs, you know, monthly meet and greets online, the sort of digital stuff where for some fan bases, there's an opportunity there. Maybe it's through TikTok, YouTube, through the digital gifting tools. And so that's really interesting that although direct fan's been around a long time, I think the nature of direct fan is changing. Interesting to see the majors wanting to get involved. But the last thing I'd say on direct fan is it is a big opportunity. Hey, the bankers at Goldman Sachs are right. Even Lucian Grange at Universal Music is right. It is a big opportunity. But the specifics of the opportunity differ greatly from artist to artist based on the fan base. And that is the challenge. And that's something we talk about more in the masterclass. And given the majors are talking a lot about super serving superfans at the moment, I'm pretty sure we're going to be talking about it over the next year here on Setlist as well.
Now stay tuned for a brief roundup of this week's music industry news stories. But now it's on to masterclass number two, music streaming in 2024. And this one covers an overview of the key streaming services, how and why the streaming model is changing, the ongoing economics of streaming debate, and user-generated content platforms and revenues. Interesting takeaway from it, number one. Track allocation is changing.
Now, regular listeners to Setlist will be very aware of this, but streaming, Spotify-type streaming, is a revenue share based on consumption share business. What the hell does that mean? Well, basically, most of the streaming services, certainly the music-specific streaming services, they have a relationship with the music industry, with record labels, music distributors, music publishers, collect societies, and down the supply chain with artists and songwriters, where they basically say, every month we will share usually 65 to 70% of our revenue with the music industry. And then we'll allocate it across the industry, partly based on consumption share, and then we'll have a revenue share relationship in our licensing deal where of the money allocated to your tracks, maybe you get 55%, 52%, or if you're on the song side, more like 10 to 15%. So that's the way streaming works from a business model perspective. Now, we all know that for many, many years, plenty of people in the artist and songwriter community, lots of managers, and indeed plenty of indie record labels and music publishers have been saying that there are issues with the model and the way the model works, and we should change the model. And an assortment of changes have been proposed over the years. But until 2023, the major record companies didn't really talk about changing the model. Because most artists and songwriters and indie labels and publishers would argue, the model was developed in the late 2000s by the major record companies to suit major record companies. So until relatively recently, the model seemed to be pretty good for Universal and Sony and Warner. But a year ago, that changed, and the majors started calling for changes to the model as well. And as a result, changes have now started to happen. But where the changes are happening is to the step of the process where streaming services allocate money to tracks, to individual tracks on the system, based on consumption share. So at a very basic level, there's 100 million plus tracks on Spotify, and for each track in the system, how much of the money they're going to earn is impacted by what percentage of consumption that track accounted for. If a track accounted for 0.00001% of total listening in the UK on Spotify Premium in any one month, it's going to be allocated 0.00001% of the money, and then we'll get a share of that money. And it's that track allocation process where we're starting to see people meddling with the system, because those are the changes the majors wanted. And basically, what we're starting to see is that all plays are no longer equal. Some plays are worth more than other plays when it comes to calculating consumption share. Whereas previously, it didn't matter what the track was, it didn't matter how it was played. Providing it was listened to for more than 30 seconds, a play was counted. That is changing. So Spotify are putting new rules in place for so-called functional audio. There's a threshold that each track has to pass each year to get paid anything. Apple are prioritizing music that is provided in spatial audio, because that's Apple's priority at the moment. So things are changing to the track allocation process. Not all tracks are being treated equal anymore. And it has to be said that while artists and songwriters and indie labels and publishers have been calling for a change to the model for years, they're not necessarily happy with the specific changes that have been made, and certainly not the way in which the changes were made behind the scenes. So, changes are happening. They are controversial. We explain what they are in the masterclass, and this is an ongoing story. We're going to be talking more about this on future editions of Setlist, I guarantee it.
Now, as well as that, another thing that remains in the spotlight is reforming music maker remuneration.
Yeah, I mentioned that artists and songwriters and their managers have been calling for a change to the model for quite some time. And one of the things that has been debated a lot is how, once money flows through the recorded side of the business, through record labels and music distributors, how the money is shared out between the label and the artist. So that's one very specific element of the model that has been discussed a lot. Now, how much of the money an artist sees on the recorded side depends entirely on their deal with their business partner that is working with them on their recordings, whether that's a label or a distributor. They could be getting 100% of the money, or they could be getting a few percent of the money if they were foolish enough to do their record deal 50 years ago with a label that has decided to apply CD royalty rates to streaming income. So there has been lots of debate over the years over whether or not certain artists, particularly heritage artists locked in old record deals, session musicians also, who currently don't get any share of streaming, whether or not some artists have basically been screwed over by the industry, or at least some players in the industry. And if they have, what do we do about that? Is it something that the industry could address through some sort of voluntary agreement? So we know, for example, that the Beggars Group in the UK, one of the big independent labels, pays a minimum royalty rate to all of the artists across its catalogue, oblivious of what any specific deal signed in, I don't know, 1993 might say. Beggars also pay through on unrecouped balances after 15 years. So that's a solution to the problem, certainly for heritage artists, not so much for session musicians. So could the entire industry embrace something similar? Or should copyright law be rewritten to empower artists? Now, the key thing is the very high-profile, headline-grabbing changes that have happened at Spotify and at Apple and also at Deezer, they don't deal with any of those issues. It's a totally different bit of the business model that's currently being changed. All the debates around artist remuneration, particularly for heritage artists and session musicians, they are still on the agenda. And here in the UK, obviously, there have been the government-led economics of streaming work that's been ongoing ever since the UK Parliament did its big inquiry into streaming. And as part of that, there's meant to be a working group specifically looking at this element of remuneration, how artists get paid. I haven't actually met yet, but I have been told it's due to meet very soon. So Key point is, when it comes to how the money is shared between labels and artists, none of the changes to the model address any of those concerns. In the UK, this is going to become a much bigger talking point in the months ahead.
Now, as promised, we are going to take a brief look at some of this week's biggest and most interesting music industry news stories, starting with Apple, which is reportedly facing a 500 million euro fine from EU regulators who have concluded that it breached competition law with rules regarding in-app payments on its App Store. The investigation that led to this was prompted almost 5 years ago by a complaint from Spotify. Sticking with the European Union, it is also about to investigate whether TikTok has breached online safety rules under its new Digital Services Act, which came into full force last week but began applying to 17 very large online platforms, including TikTok, last year. As licensing negotiations between TikTok and Universal collapsed last month, the major label highlighted a tidal wave of hate speech, bigotry, bullying, and harassment on TikTok as one of its key concerns about the platform. More news from Universal Music now, and the major label has acquired a minority stake in Chord Music, which is a firm set up in 2021 to buy up music rights. It was launched by investment firms KKR and Dundee Partners. Universal is buying KKR out of the firm for $240 million, getting itself a 25.8% stake in the company and giving it an overall valuation of $1.85 billion. The Chord catalogue includes songs by artists including The Weeknd, Ryan Tedder, David Guetta, and Lorde. An appeals court in the US has overturned a billion-dollar damages ruling won by the major record companies against American ISP Cox Communications. While the appeals judges did accept that Cox had been engaged in copyright infringement, they said that it was not liable for vicarious infringement, which would mean that it had had both control over the infringement and benefited from it financially, and that means that the amount of damages will have to be reconsidered. And lastly, in this news in brief section, before we get back to looking at the music business in 2024, it's the Beatles. The band's company AppleCore has done a deal with Sony Pictures, director Sam Mendes and his Neil Street Productions company to make four biopics, each one told from a different band member's perspective. Under any normal circumstances, that would probably seem like too many films. But of course, we did all watch the very long Get Back documentary, and that was good. So it's fine. Anyway, those films are scheduled for release in 2027, so you've got time to get used to the idea. If you want to read more about any of these stories, you will find links in the show notes or at completemusicupdate.com. Now on to masterclass number 3, music copyright in 2024, which covers things such as music rights revenue streams, the copyright obligations of AI platforms, the evolution of music piracy, and song theft cases from Blurred Lines to Thinking Out Loud. But what's our first interesting takeaway from this masterclass? Well, web blocking is still an anti-piracy tactic of choice, but who should you block?
Yeah, most of this masterclass is about how we make money out of our music rights and all of the revenue streams. But I thought I'd focus on the scenarios where we don't make money from our music copyright because those pesky internet users are stealing it. And we don't talk as much about music piracy anymore, do we? I mean, I think Andy could confirm that there was a period where in the See Me Daily and on Setlist, we wrote and talked a lot about music piracy.
Huge amount.
Do you miss those days?
Yeah.
When the music industry was doomed?
Yeah, I've got a certain nostalgia for that. I mean, some of that time predates me working for CMU. So it's the nostalgia for when I just read it, I guess.
Well, the good news for fans of music piracy like Andy Malt, I think that's what you just said. Is that what you just said?
Yeah, I love it.
Music piracy has not gone away. Last year, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, in its annual study of music consumers, found that 29% of the people they surveyed are still accessing music via unlicensed services. Bad people. And if you think that's just old people who are sort of nostalgic for the Napster / Grokster / Kazaa / Pirate Bay era, even the people nostalgic for the Pirate Bay era, we can call them old now, I think, can't we?
Yeah.
It's not just old people who are continuing to pirate. In fact, if you just take the 16 to 24-year-olds who were surveyed by IFPI, 43% are accessing piracy services. So it is by no means as big an issue as it used to be. Obviously, the record industry has been in growth for nearly 10 years now on the back of the streaming boom. But there are still people accessing things like stream ripping sites, and there are some unlicensed music apps that people are downloading onto their phones. So what does the music industry do when piracy is still a problem? And in recent years, actually probably now for nearly 10 years, certainly the last 5 years, the anti-piracy tactic of choice for the music industry in many countries around the world is web blocking. And basically, this is a thing where rather than suing the website that is allowing copyright infringement, maybe that's a stream ripping website, rather than going after the people who are actually infringing copyright by downloading or stream ripping the music, is basically you go to court, usually you do this through a court of law, and you get a web blocking injunction against internet service providers. So in the UK, you get an injunction against Virgin and Vodafone and BT. And then what the court order, the injunction says, is that those ISPs have to block access to the piracy sites. So when their customers type in the Pirate Bay dot, what domain did they end up with? They kept moving domains, didn't they?
Oh, there were so many. That was I enjoyed that. That was fun when they kept moving domains.
Let's say .org, .se, I don't know. If you go to the Pirate Bay's website, rather than going to the Pirate Bay's website, you see a Virgin Media message or a Vodafone message saying, this website's blocked, don't use this, go and use Spotify, or worse to that effect. So that's web blocking. Web blocking court orders are not available everywhere in the world, but they're available in many countries now, including the UK. And whereas in the early days of web blocking, the ISPs used to kick up a fuss, these days, in most countries, when an ISP gets a web blocking order, they just block the website and they get on with their life. Great. Except, if you know what you're doing, you can actually circumvent an ISP's web block by either using a VPN, a virtual private network, or a thing called a DNS resolver. So there are other internet tools you can use to circumvent the blocks. And so what the music industry has started to say is, OK, if people are using this thing called a DNS resolver to circumvent Vodafone's web block, can we go after the companies that offer these third-party DNS resolvers and get them to instigate web blocks? And that's what the music industry has been doing over the last couple of years, particularly in Europe, in Germany and in Italy. Initially with some success. So the two that were targeted was a DNS resolver called Quad9, also a DNS resolver offered by Cloudflare called 1111. And initially in both Italy and Germany, they had some success and the courts were issuing web blocking orders against the DNS resolvers. In Italy, that's still the case, but in Germany, we started to see the courts go in the other direction. So this is very much an ongoing story. But, you know, from a copyright perspective, it is interesting to know piracy is still a problem, even though it's not the massive problem that it used to be. There are tactics that the music industry can employ, but the tactics are constantly evolving.
Next in music copyright, we have more clarity of the hurdles artists need to prove song theft. And of course, by song theft, we're talking about when one songwriter is accused of taking part of another songwriter's song and using it for their own without permission. We're obviously not talking about licensed interpolation, which is another growing trend in music copyright, but this is unauthorized use of someone else's work for your own work, allegedly.
Yeah, we refer to that as song theft, even though that kind of implies it's a criminal offence. It's not.
No, it's not.
It's a civil case for copyright infringement. And obviously, there have been lots of big headline-grabbing lawsuits, mainly in the US, occasionally here in the UK, where, yeah, as you say, you have one artist accusing another artist of ripping off their music. The Blurred Lines case back in 2015, the big famous case, which many people thought had set a precedent that where you had a song that had a similar vibe, to use Pharrell Williams' term, to an earlier song, that could constitute copyright infringement. Some people felt that the Blurred Lines ruling, where Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams were found liable for copyright infringement for making their song far too similar to Marvin Gaye's Gotta Give It Up, that it actually set a dangerous precedent and it would make it easier for artists to accuse new artists of ripping off their work. But I would say the cases that we've seen since the Blurred Lines litigation have shown that actually there's still quite a big hurdle to cross to prove song theft, to prove liability of copyright infringement, where you have a new song that isn't a direct ripoff of an old song, but has elements in common. And in the last couple of years, we've had a little bit of clarity on the obligations in order to prove song theft, courtesy of Mr. Edward Sheeran, who has been sued a lot, hasn't he?
So much. So there was just so much.
Two cases involving Ed Sheeran, one in the US and one in the UK. And when somebody is accused of ripping off an earlier song, there are two things that you have to show in order to prove copyright infringement. Firstly, that whoever is accused of ripping off an earlier song had access to the earlier song. They don't actually have to have deliberately set out to rip it off, but they have to have been exposed to the earlier song for infringement to take place. Now, if the earlier song is really famous, we can take that as read. But if the earlier song actually isn't so well known, then you've got to prove access. And then the second thing you've got to show is that the similarity between the old song and the new song is sufficient for copyright infringement to have occurred. Now, if we take each of those issues in turn, with the Ed Sheeran cases, actually it was the UK case where he was accused of ripping off an earlier song on Shape of You, where I would say a good precedent was set. And so in the judgment for that case, the judge noted that in court, there was some debate as to whether what was required was proof of access or proof of possibility of access. And what the judge in the Shape of You case in the UK court said, it's the latter. So this is important because, of course, these days, it's really easy to get your tracks on YouTube or Spotify. And so often you're getting these cases where people say, OK, no one's heard of my song, but it was on Spotify. So that's how the famous new artist managed to hear my old song. And that is not enough. And that's present in the UK courts, but we've seen similar things happening in the US courts as well. You've got to show a better theory of access than just my music was online. And then in terms of similarity, where you've got two songs that are not direct ripoffs, but they share some musical segments, the question is, well, will those musical segments taken out of the songs, are they substantial enough for there to be copyright protection at all in those musical segments? So wrapping up in the Ed Sheeran case in the US, this was in relation to allegations that Thinking Out Loud had ripped off another Marvin Gaye song. And in that case, Ed Sheeran's lawyer said that Marvin Gaye's co-writer on the earlier song, also called Ed Townsend, did not create these basic musical building blocks that the old song and the new song have in common. And if we say that those building blocks are protected by copyright so that one artist can be liable for infringement for using the same musical building blocks as an earlier song, well, that will just destroy the songwriting process. And Ed Sheeran won in that case. And I think what we've seen with a number of rulings, these are mainly in the US courts now, that just having some musical segments in common, you know, a chord progression or a few beats, a few notes, generally speaking, is not enough. You've got to show more substantial similarity between the two songs. So I would say that those are common sense judgments. I think those are correct precedents. I'm glad the courts have set it. And that's one of the things that we talk about in our copyright masterclass.
And finally, on to our fourth and last masterclass, Music and AI in 2024. This one gives an overview of music making generative AI, the legal challenges of AI, the commercial opportunities in AI, and how music companies are using AI today. And our first talking point from this one is the ongoing dispute over the copyright obligation of AI companies.
Yeah, this is one that Regulations of Setlist will be on top of, but we do explain it in more detail in the masterclass. If you have a generative AI model that is designed to generate music, songs and recordings, you need to expose your AI model to existing music, to existing songs and existing recordings. And I guess if you're going to do that, there's a couple of things that you can do. You could hire some musicians and songwriters and pay them and get them to create a load of music and then use that music to train your model. But easier to get an existing catalogue of music, whether that's production music, so library music that was designed to go into movies and ads and stuff like that, or indeed commercial release music, the music that we all know that's available on Spotify. And of course, the big copyright question is, if an AI company uses existing music to train their models, do they need to get permission from whoever controls and owns the copyright in that music. So on the recorded side, likely to be a record label or a music distributor. On the song side, a music publisher, possibly a collecting society. And then, of course, what about the artists involved in the recording, the songwriters involved in the song? Is permission needed? Now, the music industry would say, really easy question. Super easy question. The easiest copyright question to ever have been asked. Of course you need permission to use existing music to train your AI model. At the very least, you are going to copy the music onto your server in order to train it in the ingestion process. That's a copy. Copies need to be licensed. Come and negotiate a deal. But of course, we know some AI companies are arguing that there are exceptions in copyright law, usually around data mining, that they think apply to AI training. Now, in most countries, although there are copyright exceptions in pretty much every country, but in most countries, there are not copyright exceptions that can be used for training AI. But the AI companies argue that there are in a small number of countries, and lo and behold, those are the countries where they've decided to put their servers. Or, if you have your servers in the US, can you rely on the always tricky, ambiguous concept of fair use under American copyright law? The music industry says no, no exceptions, not fair use. The AI companies reckon that there is an argument for being able to use existing music without getting a license. Some AI companies have actually got licenses, particularly for production music. But nevertheless, a lot of the big tech companies are arguing no permission is required. And so this is a big ongoing dispute. There are some test cases in court, particularly in the US, but also in the UK and in Europe. Most of those are not actually music cases. They're other kinds of content, but the copyright question is the same. There is actually a music case in the US, although specifically around lyrics. So we're waiting to see how those test court cases go. But actually, they're probably going to take years to go through the system. What the music industry really wants is for governments or parliaments and legislatures to say, no, you need to get permission. That's what copyright law says. Or if it doesn't, we'll change copyright law so it does. So it's very much an ongoing debate for the entire music industry. We talk about it a lot on Setlist. We explain it in the Masterclass. I predict within the next 3 weeks, we're going to be talking more about this on Setlist because something else is going to happen very soon.
And we've reached our last talking point on AI and indeed the music business in 2024. And this one is, now that artists and music companies are using AI, what do they need to be aware of?
Yeah, so we've talked a lot on Setlist and in the CMU Daily about AI companies using music in order to train their models. But what about music makers and music companies making use of AI themselves? Whether that's artists and songwriters and producers using AI as part of the songwriting process or within the production process, maybe to do their mastering. Or maybe it's artists and their labels and their management teams using AI to generate all of that content that we now need to have around our releases. The visual stuff, the images, the videos. There are AI tools that can help with that. Plus, there are AI tools, both generative AI and otherwise, that can help music companies with things like data management and scrutinizing data and making, you know, legal documents and stuff like that. So we're seeing an increasing number of people across the music industry using AI, whether that's as part of the creative process or in marketing or in the business at large. So one of the things we think about at the end of our AI masterclass is, if that's you, what do you need to be thinking about? And there are just a couple of things that you should be considering when you're using AI as part of your business. First of all, generative AI in the main is not perfect. And so, for example, if you're using generative AI to write a contract or a document about your company, maybe some marketing copy, it should always be used as a first draft because sometimes you get what they call hallucinations. Sometimes generative AI will make up quotes. If you get generative AI to write a press release, it may be that the generative AI makes up a quote from Andy Malt at CMU saying how great your artist is. And Andy Malt at CMU didn't say that, because you would never say that, would you? You're very negative about all music. No, that's not fair. Maybe it would write a negative quote.
I say
quote.
Positive things all the time.
Maybe it would say a negative thing from a CMU-approved artist. AI makes stuff up is the point.
Yes.
So you need to be aware of that. But there are also some legal considerations. So, for example, if you are uploading music or you're uploading photos or you're uploading copy into an AI platform in order for it to help you process or produce content, Be very careful as to what rights you're granting that platform. It may be that in the T's and C's you haven't read, you're allowing the platform to then use your content, your prompts, as part of the training process. Do you want to do that? Are you even legally allowed to do that? Is it your content? So those are things to be thinking about. And then the last thing is another copyright question with AI is, if you have AI-generated content where AI completely generates a track or a photo or whatever, is that content protected by copyright? And arguably, in many countries, the answer to that question currently is no. So if you're using AI to create the artwork for your album, maybe that artwork is not protected by copyright. Maybe I could take your artwork and start selling T-shirts with it printed on it because there's no copyright protection. So these are the sorts of things that you should be thinking about. Obviously, there's lots of fantastic stuff you can do with AI. We employ it a lot now at CMU as part of our content making process, particularly on the images side. But there are some things to be thinking about. There you go. I've given to you there. And we go into all of that in much more detail in our AI masterclass.
Yes. So as I said, if you want to go any deeper into any of this, there will be a link in the show notes where you can access those masterclasses. But that is all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. We'll be back with another episode next week, and you can keep up with all the latest music industry news every day at completemusicupdate.com.